Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. Since the tumultuous election last November, in which Democrats took the White House and gained just enough seats in the Senate to assure that there would be at least some legislative movement, as opposed to the 12-year de facto filibuster led by Kentucky Republican Mitch McConnell, Republicans have been strategizing, as would be expected, on how to regain control of one or both of the houses. In the lead-up to the last election, Republicans appealed to Black and Latino voters and saw modest gains in those vote percentages, mainly by scapegoating each constituency in appeals to the other. And they've rallied their base with fear-mongering about gun control, a strategy that worked well for them in 2000. While for the less politically literate, buzzwords like socialism and the myth of an immigrant invasion proved to be powerful motivators. But the 2020 election year saw millions of new voters entering the fray, mostly registered by civic organizations and even the Bernie Sanders primary campaign, and a statistical majority of those were people of color, many of them exasperated with the highly publicized and seemingly all too frequent police killings of Black and brown people by white police officers. The Black Lives Matter movement, when not preoccupied with physical protests, lent its collective muscle to the get-out-the-vote efforts across the nation. Thus, the unwhitening of the electorate became more of a factor than ever before, and in the key battleground states like Georgia, Arizona, and Michigan, non-white voters played a decisive role. But the Republican Party's loyalty to and fealty toward the outgoing regime could be measured in the vehemence with which they echoed the so-called big lie about voter fraud, which the previous president had alleged was so ubiquitous and great that the 8 million vote lead enjoyed by Joe Biden in the popular vote was entirely a function of electoral manipulation and false ballots. To date, no firm evidence of such fraud has been offered, nor has it been demanded by the previous administration's followers. Dozens of lawsuits filed by Republicans at both the federal level and in numerous states were thrown out, even by conservative judges appointed to the bench within the previous administration's tenure. And the certification of the electoral votes and the inauguration all took place nearly on schedule, so there was no longer a legal remedy to be sought, even if the GOP had an actual case. Soon, however, a curious development unfolded. A series of bills were introduced in states with Republican majorities in the state legislatures aimed at limiting voter access to the polls. These included shortening early voter hours, limiting the hours of polling places during early voting and even on election day, increasing voter ID requirements and limiting the use of absentee balloting. Automatic voter registrations, already in practice in some states, were targeted for elimination. Ballot drop boxes were limited or removed, or at least this is what the bills proposed. And in Georgia, where both Senate seats flipped in the 11th hour to progressive Democrats, thanks to majorities in that state's highly diverse metropolitan districts, a raft of bills passed by the Republican-dominated legislature that signed into law by Governor Kemp, who himself had been criticized for engaging in racially targeted voter suppression in his previous position as Secretary of State. One of the new laws there even makes it a crime to offer drinking water to voters standing in line waiting to vote. And those lines in Georgia got considerably longer under Kent's reign as he closed hundreds of polling places, mainly in communities of color and in rural counties, disproportionately affecting Black and brown voters. A few weeks ago, there were a reported 253 such pieces of legislation being pushed in 43 states. That number has since grown dramatically, but there's a new federal bill that would recodify certain voting rights guarantees, undoing some of the damage done when the Supreme Court effectively gutted the 1965 Voting Rights Act a few years ago, and even expanding ballot access further by standardizing voter registration policies nationwide. I spoke with Jen Miller, who directs the League of Women Voters here in Columbus.
So as I was reading up about this topic of voter suppression laws being proposed and such, several weeks ago there were reports that some 253 pieces of legislation had been introduced in 43 states around the country. all targeting voter suppression in one form or another. The most famous of those, of course, has been Georgia, where the most draconian measures have been passed into law now. And, of course, Georgia was one of the states covered by the Voting Rights Act, Section 5, for preclearance, meaning that they had to get all changes to voting procedures and policies pre-approved by the Department of Justice to make sure that they didn't discriminate against minority constituencies. That, of course, was gutted by the Supreme Court. And as soon as that happens, of course, there was a flood of voter suppression measures and restrictions, but nothing like what we've seen now. And today, as I was reading up on this, I find that the number has increased in just the last 3 weeks from 253 measures to 361. What kind of insights can you offer, and is my interpretation correct on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think even by the time this airs, there could be more pieces of legislation. One thing we need to keep in mind is that every state can potentially have thousands of pieces of legislation that get introduced and may not move. With that said, there clearly is a this idea of making voting more difficult, creating more hoops to jump through. And while that can, you know, so and those conversations are happening in Ohio as well. Just because the legislation hasn't been introduced doesn't mean that we should sit back and not worry about it, because in fact there is conversations right now going on there are conversations among legislators happening right now.
So what is on the horizon in Ohio, and how does that compare to states like Georgia? And maybe just for the listeners' recollection, if you could describe some of the current legislation in other states that has passed or is being considered.
Well, I mean, the themes across the country are to make absentee voting more difficult. If there is early voting, to reduce that. To maybe make ID laws more restrictive, which we already have ID laws in Ohio, but they could, you know, there's ideas potentially of making them more restrictive. So there's a lot of different themes. I can't really tell you exactly what is going to be in the Ohio legislation until it's introduced. I know the kinds of conversations that are being had, and they are along similar lines as many other states. So, you know, we need to worry about things like our absentee process, for example. You already have to prove yourself twice, once to qualify for the ballot and then once for the ballot to count. You have to, you know, that's the only kind of voting in Ohio where you prove yourself twice. And there are talks about increasing those requirements, you know, making that actually harder. In terms of how you prove yourself. Definitely conversations about early voting. And there's definitely a lot of support among Republicans and Democrats, among the general population and lawmakers for early voting, but we could see some reductions in that. So we are just remaining vigilant at this point. But I do think, since there is such a national conversation about voting access, you know, it's really valid to be talking about federal legislation. So the League of Women Voters certainly supports H.R. 1, the For the People Act, that passed the House and is a slightly different version is being considered in the U.S. Senate. And we do encourage all your listeners to call our senators and ask for their support for the People Act. You know, voting is a foundational right. All of the rest of our rights in this representative democracy really start with voting. Who do we elect to represent us, to make various decisions for us, and how government runs and affects our everyday lives? And so, with that idea that voting is a foundational right, I think it's absolutely reasonable that every state need to meet some minimum standards that are in the, you know, For the People Act. Some of those things we already have, such as the rights of individuals who are re-entering the community after serving time for a felony. That's something we already have, but that would extend those rights across the country. Absentee voting, early voting are things that we have, but it would protect them so that a Secretary of State couldn't just come in and get rid of them completely. So there's a lot of good things in there that just really, I think, lay even to the playing field. Because let's keep in mind that every state elects the president that we all deal with. And also every state puts in office Congress members that have to work together across not even just political parties, but across state lines. And the same with U.S. Senate. So the idea of having a more national approach to voting access is one that I support, so that we can be sure that voters really had the freedom to select their representatives, and that across the country, since our reps have to work with all the other reps in other states.
Indeed, arguments have been made that having different laws pertaining to ballot access and voting procedures from state to state just by itself stands in violation of the 14th Amendment, or the Equal Protection Act. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 recognized that and introduced a formula by which states with histories of discrimination were singled out for special provisions, special protections under that Voting Rights Act. Now that that's no longer been the case, we've actually seen a widening of the disparity between policies from one state to the next. Now, I mentioned that earlier, there are some 361 pieces of legislation aimed at voter suppression in 43 states, but the Brennan Center report also notes that there's an approximately equal number of state measures in support of voting rights that would actually expand ballot access. Those aren't discussed in detail, but how would those individual state measures differ from the national, the federal act that's being introduced?
Well, you know, I'm not an expert on what's happening in all the states. Here's the bottom line is no one can really, one person can't track all the legislation just introduced in our own state house, let alone across the country. Let me say this, though. I mean, I think that even some of these bills that you could term as voter suppression might have some things in there that voter advocates like. And so that doesn't mean that overall it's a good bill. And so I think we will see in Ohio probably some sort of mixed bill. I think, and so the kinds of things that we would like to see, though, is, of course, online absentee requests. Of course, expansion of ID requirements so that a county ID or a U.S. passport could be used to prove your identity at the polls. Other things that we would love to see is codification of early voting in law, because right now that's a decision made by the Secretary of State, because the court order that created that process has now expired, but we continue to have early voting, but multiple early voting locations and multiple drop boxes per county. These are all things that we would like to see. I think my message to the General Assembly would be we had a successful election. We do not have security problems here in Ohio, and so let's not cook up solutions to problems that don't exist. Instead, let's look at what could be better. Something like online absentee requests helps voters and boards of elections both, because it's just a more efficient, streamlined process. Automatic voter registration is great for voters because a lot of voters forget to update their addresses, and then we end up having high provisional ballot counts. If there's a line and a voter goes in and they have forgotten to update their address, and then they go and do a provisional ballot, that's harder on that voter, but it also makes the lines longer for everyone. So we can make our voter rolls more accurate and secure for everyone with something like automatic voter registration. There's so many things like that that we hope to achieve in this General Assembly. Another one, I think, in Ohio that's particularly interesting is just about vendors. So in Ohio, our voting machines are certified for security and accuracy, but there's a lot of other vendors that probably should also go through some sort of process. Like we saw with a heavily mail voting situation this past year, that like the mail houses, the printers had just taken on too much work and therefore had delays. You know, some sort of certification process that assures that these vendors are fair and nonpartisan, and that they have the capacity to fulfill the bids that they are providing to boards of elections. Those would be things that we would really support.
Indeed, there were several counties in which the boards of elections had to print their own absentee ballots and other materials that would otherwise have been contracted because the contractors that they engaged were unable to provide them in a timely manner. That's an extra burden to the boards of election. The legislations that are being proposed, and some have passed in a number of states around the country, that curtail early voting, that add ID requirements, that essentially throw up smaller but abundant obstacles to voter registration and ballot access, and preclude certain categories of people from participating, do seem to have an adverse and disproportionately adverse impact on people of color, poor people, students, itinerant workers, etc. Why exactly would those proposals be targeting those people, and why is it that they are disproportionately affected?
So I think sometimes laws are designed to suppress, and I think that there's a lot of other times laws are designed that end up just having unintended consequences, right? But you are correct. So something like if a state goes to an ID requirement that it has to be a state ID, then you're going to have populations that just don't have state IDs. College students potentially that don't own cars, folks with disabilities, senior citizens, potentially lower income individuals. And so that's one of those where maybe some of the supporters of an ID law think that they're making something more secure and they're making the voting system better, but actually it's harming so many populations that it does harm our democracy. You know, I can't get in the minds of people so much, but I do want to say this. I think that a lot of people don't fundamentally understand how elections operate, and it's a little bit like when you tug on one thing, it affects a whole bunch of other things. And so I think one of the things that we need to do now is we need to educate lawmakers about what the challenges are in our elections and what the strengths of our elections are. And I would say our elections here in Ohio especially are really great in that you have these bipartisan approaches where elections officials on both sides of the aisle are working really hard to make sure everyone can vote, and that you know, we have post-election audits. We have so many things that we do so well that actually working to improve access is really just that. It's going to be a positive for the entire system and for all voters.
Now, of course, the proponents and opponents of the various legislations that that are being introduced or have passed, as well as to the national legislation currently on its way to the Senate, have been divided largely along partisan lines. And I know that the League of Women Voters is, by definition, a nonpartisan organization. However, there are political powers lining up on both sides of the issue. Is there a danger in your perception that the partisanification of the debate over voting rights it is heading us toward a kind of a repeat of the political climate that existed prior to the passage of the Voting Rights Act and shortly thereafter in 1965?
You know, that's an interesting question. I'll just say this about partisanship. We're seeing that everywhere, right? And I do hope we'll spend a minute talking about gerrymandering, because what we're seeing with gerrymandering, which is maps that are really designed to secure partisan outcomes, is that the more gerrymandered legislative maps are, the less crossing of the aisles to work with individuals, the more extreme the candidates are, the more dysfunctional our government is. And so I do think that, you know, in terms of the general population, Ohio voters, Republican and Democrat, across the state, in every county, care about voting freedom, right? They care about having a democracy that functions, and they care about fairness. And so while we see some of this falling along partisan lines in decision making by lawmakers, that doesn't necessarily represent the will of the people. And I think it's hard to talk about something like voting access and not talk about the extremes that we might have in our legislature.
That's a good segue into what was going to be my next question about the gerrymandered majorities in state legislatures where the voter suppression proposals are moving forward, those that are identified as voter suppression proposals, that they tend to be authored and advanced by Republican majorities in state legislatures where gerrymandering has played a decisive role in determining the balance of power in those legislative bodies. So you're involved also in an effort to get a redistricting formula for Ohio, which eliminates gerrymandering and removes certain other vulnerabilities in the redistricting process.
Yeah, so the League of Women Voters of Ohio has worked on fair maps, fair legislative map making for a half a century. This has been a priority for us when Democrats actually were the ones rigging maps to secure Democratic majorities, and now that Republicans do so in Ohio. We should understand that Ohio has some of the worst gerrymandering in the country. Academics across the country who specialize in legislative map making agree that we have one of the worst maps in the country for partisan gerrymandering. So let's talk about what that is. It's a human instinct. If your team is winning, your team has some sort of competitive advantage, to then use that competitive advantage to grow that competitive advantage over time. So we make new maps every 10 years. And what we have is a drawing of lines, both for state House, state Senate, and Ohio's congressional districts, that is designed solely to keep a Republican majority. And again, this isn't about us being anti-Republican. We are pro-voter. And our understanding is that even if you're a Republican in a state with a supermajority of Republicans, you are a Democrat who lives in a Democratic district, for example, every voter is harmed by gerrymandering. Why? Because once someone is in office, they know that they're going to win their office again. They don't have to listen to us, whether it's voting rights or environmental action or education funding, whatever the issue is, they don't actually have to listen to the people and represent the people. And so in our mind, it's voters against bad maps. And that's what we saw in 2015 and 2018. We finally were able to get issues on the ballot that passed to bring some more fairness to the people of Ohio. So in 2015, I'm sure a lot of your listeners voted yes on issue one for how we make state legislative maps. That passed in all 88 counties by 72% of the vote, almost. And then in 2018, the reforms for how we make congressional maps in Ohio passed by almost 75% of the vote in all 88 counties. What that tells us is that, again, Republicans and Democrats across Ohio care about fairness, and they care about our democracy. And so now we are getting ready to implement those reforms, and it is our sincere hope that we will have more fair maps for this upcoming decade.
Is there anything in the federal bill that would standardize the redistricting processes from one state to the next across the country?
Yeah, actually, what the federal bill has is something that we've been working on for a long time. So our dream has been an independent redistricting commission that's not made of politicians, but actually is made up of everyday people. It could be, you know, lawyers or academics, various kinds of experts, diverse community representatives, to make the map instead. We think that individuals who are just trying to make maps that work, that just truly represent the people of a state, rather than having to try to take off their kind of politician hat, is much better. So that's what's in the For the People Act, our requirement for independent redistricting commissions. That's better than what we have here in Ohio. We were not able to get that ever passed here in Ohio. And so what we have are some improvements that should curb gerrymandering, but I certainly would applaud if H.R. 1 passed. And let's keep in mind that because gerrymandering is a problem across the country, and again, because Republicans and Democrats gerrymander, you know, even the cases that went to the U.S. Supreme Court, one was about unfair gerrymander that Democrats did. Others were about unfair gerrymanders that Republicans did. Because both parties do it, an independent commission is really the best option for voters. And so that's another great reason for folks to be calling our senators from Ohio and asking them to pass For the People Act.
And speaking of independents, independent voters who are not directly affiliated with either of the two major parties or any third party are now one of the largest voting blocks in the entire national makeup of constituencies. But redistricting is based pretty much on just the Democratic and Republican voter registrations, is it not? Or do I misunderstand that?
No, it doesn't have to be. So that's what I'm actually saying, is that we should be drawing lines. They have to be approximately equal in population. We should be drawing lines based on keeping communities together, jurisdictions together. You know, so if you think about Congressional District 15, that 10 years ago was only three counties in the kind of greater Franklin County area, and now is 15 counties. That includes parts of Ohio State University and parts of OU. You can argue that it's very difficult for a congressperson to truly represent the needs of such a disparate, sprawling congressional district. Even something like COVID and infrastructure, you know, the needs of our Appalachian neighbors down south for internet is a little different than what it might be in Franklin County, you know, in a place like, you know, in one of our suburbs, for example. So I know what redistricting should be based on is doing our best to keep communities together, getting to that roughly equal population that's needed, but is creating districts that are more alike economically, in terms of their needs, different things. So no, it's not necessarily about being a Republican or Democrat. But for independents, here's the point, though, is that in a state like Ohio that is so severely gerrymandered, the election happens during the primary, right? And so if you really want to be independent, you can't actually, how do you balance that with the fact that a decision, the only decision being made for who's going to represent you happens during the primary? Fair Maps takes care of that. It very much so, because while there would be some districts that remain Republican no matter what because of the population of that area, or some districts that remain Democratic no matter what because of the population of that area, you would have lots of districts that could play back and forth. And we saw that with Congressional District 15, that sometimes went Republican and sometimes went Democrat, until this last decade, that performed perfectly for Republicans. It was designed to secure a Republican seat no matter what, and it did that. We saw that even when Obama won Ohio, it went Republican. When Trump won Ohio, it went Republican. It was a perfect gerrymander on partisan terms. Independents actually have a lot more power in a system that's not partisan gerrymandered. Why? Because then every elected official wants to win those independents over. Instead of playing to extremes, which is what happens when the election is in the primary, where extreme candidates are, they're trying to out-extreme each other, instead of playing to the extremes, they're actually trying to play more towards the middle and win over those independents.
I understand one of the provisions in the federal bill also has to do with campaign finance reform and so-called dark money contributions. How would that bill reform that? And does that mirror anything that you've been working on here at the state level?
Yeah, well, absolutely. We know that, in our opinion, you know, two of the things that harms our democracy the most are partisan gerrymandering and dark money. And so we certainly support closing especially those dark money loopholes. So that the federal bill has a lot in there, and I'm not going to talk about all the pieces, but the one thing that we need to get done, however it happens at the state level, at the local level, at the federal level, is really closing those loopholes so that you as a voter can follow the money. You have an idea as to where that candidate or that issue campaign is getting its money. Because without that, it's hard for you to make your decision on what's best for you, right? It's just like if a study says that cereal will cure cancer, and then you realize that the study was done by all folks hired by a cereal company, you might question that versus an independent study, right? The same is true in politics, that knowing who's behind an issue or a candidate helps us better understand how we might vote or what we need to do.
And lastly, voting rights tends to be kind of a one-way equation. It is essentially a civil right. And once you establish a civil right or expand a civil right, it's really impossible to then limit or reduce or curtail that right without actually trampling on a civil right. So when voting rights are expanded, efforts to reduce them run contrary to the very intuition that underlies the concept of civil rights. So I understand that the federal legislation and your efforts at the state level have been to standardize and expand ballot access and make elections fairer, and that if the federal legislation passes, it would contradict a lot of the state bills that have been passing or that are being considered, essentially overruling them because it would be a federal law. But what about in the other direction? If a community, if a state, if a city wanted to expand voting rights even further, would there be any obstacle to a community doing that, such as like Oregon, for instance, with mail-in or automatic voter registration and that sort of thing?
No, actually, so first off, the For the People Act has automatic voter registration in there, but what the For the People Act is trying to do is set minimum standards. So if you have more than that already, then you know, as a state or a community, then you should be able to hold on to those. So, but I think some minimum standards across the country, again, creates fairness. And I want my brothers and sisters in every state to have access to the ballot, to have freedom to vote their conscience, because our democracy works best when everyone can participate. And you know, our congressional delegation in Ohio can better work with the delegation in Georgia if everyone has the freedom to vote in Georgia. And so we do need to be diligent and protect voting rights here in Ohio, but we do also need to think about a national perspective, because our nation's democracy is so sacred. And representational democracy is really the foundation of so many things that we do.
Great. Is there anything you would add? Anything I didn't cover?
No, I would just say right now the League of Women Voters and our friends at Common Cause and others are working on getting ready for the map making. And so we need all hands on deck. Our theory is that it is Ohio voters, Republican and Democrat, and all 88 counties who pushed state leaders to bring these reforms to the people on the ballot. And it will now be the general public that pushes these lawmakers to follow the letter and spirit of the law. So, you know, please find us online. We are on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And you can look for Fair Districts Ohio or League of Women Voters of Ohio, all kinds of volunteer opportunities, or just sign up for our mailing list so you can know what's going on.
Jen Miller of the Ohio League of Women Voters. Her group and a coalition of others, including Common Cause Ohio, recently sent an open letter to the Ohio legislature outlining what would be required to assure a fair and equitable and transparent process for the redistricting in Ohio. It's available at their website at fairdistrictsohio.org. Next, we have a couple of reports from other media sources, including Vice News, highlighting voter suppression efforts in Georgia and North Carolina, and an interview with an Ohio researcher who uncovered what would have been a fairly significant fraud in this state at the state level prior to the 2020 election had he not exposed and documented the purging of tens of thousands of voters from the state's voter rolls.
Yeah, we say that.
Hi, Debbie. This is Tomas Lopez calling from Democracy North Carolina and our nonpartisan election protection hotline. Wanted to flag an issue that a voter had flagged for us, which was over at the county senior center that, you know, they were able to successfully vote, but that when they were checking in, the poll greeter asked about their religion.
Got another Henderson County. Flat Rock Village Hall, polling place not accepting people's ballots due to moisture on the ballot. Voter is concerned and said this happened to many people. Moisture. Do you want to take that one?
Rejecting wet ballots and asking super personal questions may not be what most people think of when they think voter suppression. But that's exactly what the volunteers at Democracy North Carolina are worried about. little ways people are made uncomfortable and pushed away from voting.
Hello, this is Shelby.
Tomas Lopez and his team are getting a record number of calls to their hotline, which tracks problems voters are running into across the state. What happens in this boiler room?
Most voters who are calling, they're trying to figure out how to navigate the voting process in very broad terms. They want to figure out where to go. They want to figure out what they need to do to be able to register to vote at their early voting place. This year, we're getting tons of questions, as you could imagine, about mail voting. We're also getting questions with people sometimes concerned at, you know, there's been a lot of talk about voter intimidation. You know, we're not getting tons of calls in terms of volume at this point about that, but we are seeing some incidents involving, in particular, aggressive electioneering near polling locations.
People here are stressed. They know North Carolina, one of the swingiest of all the swing states, could be the key to the election. For weeks, voters have been hearing the president rail against ballot fraud, and his campaign is even recruiting Election Day volunteers called the Army for Trump.
I'm urging my supporters to go into the polls and watch very carefully, because that's what has to happen. I am urging them to do it.
Trump's words did inspire Juan Cortez, but maybe not in the way the president hoped. He's now one of Democracy North Carolina's vote protectors, nonpartisan volunteers who are monitoring polling places to make sure no one has any issues casting their ballots. Why did you want to come out?
We're at a weird moment right now where it's just like, I still believe in our democratic process. And just hearing the news is people like either not being able to vote or just intimidation and the potential for intimidation made me realize like, this is still America. Like, that shouldn't be happening.
Luckily for democracy, the early voting scene in North Carolina has been pretty tame, maybe even a little boring. Even this Black Panther, who showed up in full military gear expecting the worst, was pleasantly surprised. Are you armed?
I am.
Have you had any confrontations with anyone so far?
No. Today has been smooth sailing. It has been really awesome. It's been beautiful. Just seeing my Black people, my brown people, my white people, my people, like all of these people just coming here to exercise their right.
So far, the closest thing we could find to Trump's army was this lady.
You come to tell me something you say I ought to know. Donald Trump's a nasty man and it's time for him to go. You say you will impeach him. Honey, I don't think you can, 'cause America will stand by her man.
Sherry Lynn Womack calls herself the pint-sized Dolly Parton. She's a retired military officer who now heads up North Carolina's Women for Trump and is running for re-election to her local school board. She thinks the best ways to protect the election are measures like shortening the early voting period and requiring more restrictive voter ID.
North Carolina voted for something called voters ID. We voted on it. We voted on it. Well, guess what? We don't have voters ID because of a judge.
That voter ID back and forth is just one of a number of lawsuits, right, in North Carolina?
Yeah, lots of issues.
But you think voters know what the rules are?
Yeah, I think voters know. They definitely know. They're going to say they're confused if they didn't get to vote or they missed the time or something like that. But the average voter, if they took that vote and they valued it that much, they would get the ID, they would watch the procedures, and they would know what to do.
But these so-called voter integrity measures can look a lot like voter suppression.
In North Carolina, you know, we have a recent long-term but also recent history of attempts to make voting more difficult.
Are some of the factors that might ultimately have the biggest impact in keeping people from voting these more invisible sort of systemic things?
That's often the case. So the voting rules themselves are sometimes confusing for people, especially if they're doing it for the first time. And then another unseen thing, right, is the ways in which the atmosphere around the election intersects with misinformation and disinformation and real concerns that exist. We don't know how many people are going to be deterred from voting, you know, because of the ways in which those things are interacting with one another.
Confusion is actually one of the strongest weapons of voter suppression. In the past year, rules around what signatures are required on absentee ballots and what ID you need to vote here have flipped and flopped so many times, it's nearly impossible for average voters to keep up. Groups like Equality North Carolina are fighting this kind of suppression with information, one door knock at a time.
Have you made a plan to vote, ma'am?
You know what? I know I sent a document through the Whatchamacallit?
Did you do it? Yeah.
I haven't received nothing.
You said you filled out a request form, but haven't received your ballot?
Yes.
Oh, so you haven't even gotten the ballot yet. Okay. Okay. Oh, so you want to vote at the site. Okay.
Maybe. I don't even know.
Okay.
I'm lost.
Okay.
I would love to vote.
Yeah, you need to vote because it's important. You know, we've got so many issues that are life or death right now.
Do you have time today to vote?
Today? You take me?
Yes.
You bring me back?
Yes.
Perfect.
Do it. Just do it. Go ahead and if she's ready to go, go ahead and take her.
Want to go now?
Yeah. We'll get you to the polls.
Unfortunately, a lot of people, because of circumstances and suppression, it's not something that is offered to them. The resources aren't readily available to them, and they don't have the time to be running around chasing somebody to try to get the info they need. They got to get food on their tables. They got to pay their rent.
What does it feel to have an interaction like that with a voter like that?
Those are the things that make all of the really hard days great, that you know that you got one voter there. These are the days that make us want to get up again and do it all over again.
Well, the state of Georgia is experiencing a backlash after passing voting legislation that many activists, including our next guest, say disproportionately limit the right to vote for Black and Brown voters. And in a swift move, Major League Baseball is moving their All-Star game from Georgia in response to those voting legislations. Let's chat more about this with Nsay Ufot, New Georgia Project CEO. Nsay, it's always great to have you here with us. So the Atlanta Braves said that they did not support this decision to move that All-Star game. And what was a little bit surprising to me, I also saw that Stacey Abrams said that she was also disappointed in this move. Where do you stand on this issue? Do you think that a move like this could actually force the state of Georgia perhaps to reverse this decision that they've made?
I think our current leaders in Georgia have demonstrated up to this point that they are committed to voter suppression no matter what the cost to Georgia businesses and to Georgia's workers. I think that it's been clear to us, and we've worked really hard to be clear that our actions have consequences and that voter suppression is bad for business. We've made that argument to the governor and his people, to Republicans in the state legislature, as well as to business leaders who are also our neighbors here in Georgia.
And say it's Brian Chung. So in those discussions, have you heard any sort of movement on the Republican side to maybe amend this bill, given all those things that you just said? Are they open to that conversation, especially as they're seeing a lot of these companies pull some of their business interests in the state of Georgia?
I'm hoping to see that sort of movement. But up to this point, it's been evident that their commitment to the big lie. The lie that President Trump somehow won the election and that there are voter integrity issues with Georgia's elections seems to still be the operating principle. I am now convinced that the suppressing the right to vote is the central organizing issue for national and Georgia Republicans in this moment. You have to remember that it's not just Georgia that passed this anti-voting bill or that was deliberating it, that we're looking at, 46 other states at this point who are also deliberating their own version of the anti-voting bill that was passed in Georgia. And so this is a national issue, that this is an attack on our democracy. We are looking at over 300 bills in states across the country. And so, no, they don't seem to be moved, that they seem very committed in this moment to destroying our democracy, no matter what the cost.
Okay, so it feels as if you're painting a really bleak picture here, because I think what a lot of people believe is that if you do cause at least enough economic pain and economic trouble, that you will see some movement, at least around legislation that a lot of voters and companies don't agree with. But if that's not the case in Georgia, what's then the next step? How do organizations like yours then essentially navigate this world where we do have a lot of these bills and a lot of this legislation that is restrictive to the right to vote?
So there are a couple of things. One, I think that we continue with this corporate accountability campaign, that in Georgia, we found that the companies that we were targeting had contributed over $7 million, not to the entire GOP, but to the Republican sponsors of these anti-voting bills. And so the first request is to stop funding voter suppression, that they can halt PAC contributions in the way that they did in the aftermath of the January 6th attack on our Capitol. In the way that they did in response to the 140 plus Republican legislators who worked to try to invalidate the Electoral College vote, that they could also take a similar stand in Georgia and in other states where they do business, stop funding voter suppression. One, I think two, it's HR 1 and HR 4, that it's beyond time that there has been that there's a federal standard for elections in our country. That, you know, some states have 15 days of early voting, some states have no days of early voting, and that setting a standard for elections helps to mitigate some of the partisan attacks that happen when a party loses control in their elections and then plays the sour grapes game by trying to break the elections infrastructure so that they can hold on to power or so that they don't lose in the next election cycle, and that HR 1 and HR 4, having companies, having legislators come out forcefully and say that this is a priority for us in this moment, that if we want to work on policy, that this is the right to vote and the citizens' ability to participate in our elections, to choose their leaders, and to communicate mm-hmm. what their policy priorities are, that we have to have the protections for the sacred and fundamental right to vote. And I think that that's something that it is an efficient approach so that we aren't filing lawsuits and fighting these fights in 40 plus uh-huh. legislatures across the country, that we need to set a federal standard for elections in our country. And we can do that with HR 1 and HR 4.
Very quickly, have you tried to quantify the impact on these measures on in terms of just voter turnout? Do you have a quantifiable metric of what this might do?
Well, because there's literally death by a thousand cuts, we're talking about taking drop boxes and moving them from outside of the building to inside of the building. We're talking about dropping off ballots or that voters won't be allowed to drop off ballots after business hours. So after 5 p.m. in some counties and after 7 p.m. in some counties. And so given the dozens of different attacks on the right to vote, it's difficult at this moment to quantify exactly how many people would be impacted by this. But what I can say is that we're in the middle of a surge, right? That we're a surge in participation. We had historic levels of participation in the November elections and in the January runoffs. A part of the other bill is that instead of having 9 weeks for a runoff election, the Georgia GOP has cut that down to 5 weeks. And so thinking about how many people will be foreclosed from participating because they have 4 weeks less, four fewer weeks to participate in our elections. Again, you can start to add up over time and see that this is not good for democracy. This is not good for our participation. And I'll be honest, if one person's vote is suppressed because of these anti-voting measures, then it's too much.
Another big strategy that targets not only black and brown voters disproportionately, but also students and the elderly, itinerant workers, Native Americans, poor folks, and even military personnel, is voter roll purging. Journalist Greg Pallas documented this even prior to the 2016 election, and it's been common practice for even longer than that. It's where election boards remove voters' registrations due to a voter's failure to respond to a mailed piece of correspondence asking for an address confirmation, mostly. But as the next report explains, aggressive voter roll purges often end up depriving fully eligible voters of their franchise.
I started working with voter registration data really kind of by accident. When I ran the initial queries, that was my first indication that there's a serious problem here.
Ohio is set to purge roughly 235,000 people from their voter rolls.
It was one of the loneliest moments of my life. I had this feeling that I was the only person in the world that knew the powerful government entity had messed up. This is probably one of the most difficult times in recent history for voters. It's definitely way more polarized than anything I ever have seen or imagined. So I would consider myself a voter rights watchdog. On a typical Saturday, I begin downloading voter files from the Secretary of State of Ohio and the Secretary of State of North Carolina. In 2017, I started a nonprofit called the American Voter Project, which oversees the Ohio Voter Project. I gather the voter rolls of various states and do analysis of them, mostly to prevent states from purging voters without informing them. Some of the reasons that are given by secretaries of state or state voting officials for why they perform a purge, the stated reason is usually that the voters being purged are inactive because they passed away or because they moved out of state. The state isn't always correct. In 2018 in Ohio, the Secretary of State's office, Frank LaRosa's office, announced that they were going to release the names and addresses of all the people that were going to be purged. I think the list was 235,000. I think the first query I ran was, are any of these people in active status? Because all of them should have been in confirmation status. Sure enough, like 11,000 of them were in active status. That was my first indication that there was a serious problem here. We found out that some people, their status was active in the state system, but in their county system, they were inactive. We then went back and compared the state list to three counties in Ohio and found out, sure enough, that there were 22,000 people who their statuses didn't match. It turned out that close to 40,000 people on that list probably shouldn't have been on the list. They only ended up purging about 195,000 people.
LaRose says without the transparency he is using, the errors may never have been confirmed.
It took me about 15 minutes to find the errors. It shouldn't have been that way. The state said that they were only acting on the direction of the counties. It's important that those 40,000 people were not purged. They deserve to be able to vote. It's not completely out of the realm of a possibility that if I had done analysis on the state of Georgia for most recent election for governor, that the election may have turned out differently. There was so much purging going on before that election.
He's Georgia's Secretary of State.
He has dropped more than a million voters.
She lost to Republican Brian Kemp by less than 2% of the vote.
Nothing in what I do is partisan. I can't determine a particular voter's party preference. There's no shading of that data in any particular way that would be partisan or otherwise. What's at stake right now with the election coming up is really just providing a level playing field. You need to make certain that everyone's vote counts. Everyone associated with elections should want someone like me doing what I'm doing. This is probably one of the most difficult times in recent history for voters. It seems like 20 years ago, everything kind of took a hit. When you look at the Brooks Brothers riot, that was a direct attempt to stop voting. When you look at the Supreme Court decision in 2000, it was a Supreme Court decision unlike any other. And it just seems like we keep taking steps backwards away from, you know, the American ideal. It pains me that we're even talking about things like this. Power of the vote, there are a lot of attempts right now to erode that power. What I do and how I do it is not in fashion anymore. I've been called a dinosaur more than once, but it works, it's cheap, and it's very accurate. Using nothing more than a slightly souped up desktop PC, and this is just become my way of giving back.
You can reach your senators through the Senate switchboard at 202-224-3121. We'll try to follow both the local and national efforts to defend and expand voting rights in future editions of Conscious Voices, which can be heard each week here at this time on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and on WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll see you all next week for another edition. We'll close the show now with the words of the late congressperson from Georgia, the Honorable John Lewis.
The gentleman from Georgia is recognized.
Madam Speaker, I rise in strong support of H.R. 1, and I urge each and every one of our colleagues to support this bill. Madam Speaker, you have heard me say on occasion that the right to vote is precious, almost sacred. In a democratic society, it is the most powerful nonviolent instrument or tool that we have. In my heart of hearts, I believe we have a moral responsibility to restore access for all of our citizens who desire to participate in the democratic process. Many people marched, protested for the right to vote. Some gave a little blood, others gave their very lives. This weekend, many of our colleagues traveled with us to Alabama, to Birmingham, to Montgomery, and to Selma. They saw the signs in the museums that said white only, color only. They visited the First Baptist Church in downtown Montgomery, where we feared for our lives as the mob waited outside to attack and kill us. They stood on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, crossing the Alabama River, where we were beaten, trampled, tear gassed while attempting to march from Selma to Montgomery to dramatize the need for voting rights. Madam Speaker, you have heard me tell the story before, and you know our work is not finished. It makes me sad. It makes me feel like crying when people are denied the right to vote. We all know that this is not a Democratic or Republican issue. It is an American one. For the past few days, I listened to the debate on this bill. I spent some time having what I call an executive session with myself. The words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. came to mind. He would often say, "The dark of the moral universe is so long, but it bends toward justice." The vote is an opportunity to be on the right side of history. It is a chance to cast a vote by the people, of the people, and for the people. So I ask you, if not us, then who? If not now, then when? The time has arrived to tear down the barrier to the ballot box. Today, we are able to do our part in this long fight for the very soul of our nation. Let's save our nation and redeem
time has expired.
The soul of America. Thank you very much.
The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org, and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.
This is Professor Howard Zinn. The independent, non-commercial radio station you're listening to is really important in the maintenance of democracy. Thomas Jefferson once said, "An informed democracy will behave in a reasonable manner." So if you care about being informed, if you care about democracy, if you're a reasonable person, you are, of course. Please support your source for uncensored news and views and the voice of your